Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. A quick share on dialogue as I was reflecting on so many of the insightful shares, such a reminder of the wisdom that we have in the community here that we all have the blessing to be able to connect with and learn from. I was thinking about some of these implicitly held beliefs that Michelle was referring to and thinking back to a conversation at work last week where one of my colleagues made a comment, and because of the shared space of wanting to create dialogue, we were able to unpack some of what was coming up there. She was making a reference to this gentleman who worked at a hedge fund, and she made this comment that he was successful and he had done well. And later on in the day, when we had a little bit more psychic space, we talked about that and the implicit assumptions that come into making such a comment, where in effect we are saying that because this person acquired financial wealth, they are therefore successful. And that kind of a conversation can't really come up unless there's a space and a trust to unpack the implicit assumptions behind those words. And we started to talk about why that's so important and how if you walk around believing that one's success and self-worth comes from acquiring financial wealth, then one may start to spend their entire life going after that because it is a form of validation. But nobody's actually agreed that that's acceptable, at least at an explicit level. It's all just implicit and taken for granted. So the more we were able to pull that out, the more we could examine that and say, well, actually, it's not just that. It matters where it comes from, how you live your life with it, et cetera. And all of a sudden, people's motivations can start to shift. So that just really resonated with me, and thank you, Michelle, for bringing that up. So to pivot a little bit to our today, we have Danny Martin joining us for a conversation. Danny, so grateful to have your presence on the call.
My pleasure, Virgil.
So as a bit of background, Danny's work has been deeply connected with the spiritual for a long time. He's got a wide-ranging background. He spent many years ordained as a Catholic priest, blending spiritual and philosophical approaches into religion. In the following years, he took that insight and he applied it to ecology. And I'll leave it to him to share a bit more about that. He actually got a PhD on the topic and worked with some of the leaders in the field. More recently, Danny's work has been around this idea of dialogue, which we've been touching on here today. He says that the art of dialogue is the art of creative interaction that allows for new meaning to emerge. Danny, there's so many places we can start. I was hoping we could start on the topic of faith. At what point did you know that your faith was something that you wanted to deepen to the point of entering priesthood?
Well, that's a powerful question to begin with, Virju. It gives me an opportunity perhaps to share a little bit about my own story. You can hear from my accent that I'm from Ireland, maybe. From Belfast, actually, a place of conflict for many, many, many years. I grew up in the midst of it. But I also grew up in on the outskirts of Belfast, which is actually a beautiful city, and used as a little boy to go up into the mountain behind our house and lie in the heather. And I got this deep sense of connection with the ground, with the heather, with the birds, with the sky, even as an 8 or a 9 year old boy. It was something I didn't understand. And a kind of a related aspect, I grew up Catholic. And I became an altar boy, as many little boys of that era did. And I used to find the same kind of experience in the early morning mass. I would get up real early. No one was particularly religious in our house, so there was no kind of obvious pressure to do this. But I was intrigued by a sense of connectedness or mystery or something. I didn't have any words for it at the time. And I'd say they were the early stirrings of a sense of faith. Not faith in any you know, from the perspective of belief. It had nothing or very little to do with beliefs, I believe in this God or that God, but more of an awareness of something deeper, stirring, living me, living in me, a connectedness with all of that. I think that was the essential piece. And then there was one other piece that I will add that maybe began to move me in a more formal direction. A couple of uncles. I was the firstborn of my mother and of my larger family. I was the first grandchild, and these two uncles were very fond of me and would take me under their wing. And they were professional men, but one of the things they used to do was go down to a nearby Trappist monastery. And they invited me one time. I was about 13 years old. I remember it was a beautiful May evening in Ireland with the hawthorn bushes almost like floodlights. And we arrived at this monastery, and I was so entranced. Everyone had gone to bed. It was only 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and all the monks were in bed. That's what they do, and get up real early in the morning. And there was this strange sense of peace, and we were met by one of the monks and brought to a simple guest room. And I stepped out onto a balcony outside of this old kind of neo-Georgian house, and I looked across at the setting sun, and there was a sycamore tree, I can remember, and there was a monk in a black and white habit standing under a sycamore tree, and the shadows of the evening sun sort of led down to the river. And for a moment, out of somewhere that I had no real previous experience of, except sort of intuitions lying in the heather, it was as if like I was connected, like a thread of fire related me and the monk and the tree and the field and the sun and the river. And I never forgot it. It was imprinted on my psyche, on my soul, and it wasn't coming from any religious place. It was just something in the formal sense. And you know what? I think it was probably a combination of that focused experience and the earlier experiences that led me down a path of searching to explore more. What is this? What is this level of living? I think that's a long answer. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to get carried away, but that probably is as close as I can get.
I love it, Danny. Part of what I love about your shares is that you paint a picture. It's not an intellectual approach only. So please continue with that if you can. And would love to dive deeper into that process of being a priest. I don't know how many years that you were one, and would love to get that as context. But would love to then dovetail into the challenges that you found in the priesthood, and what led you out?
Well, I entered a seminary, and it was very deliberate. At first, I had no real attraction to a clerical way of life. I think that's fairly honest. I was not attracted to the world of priesthood that I experienced in Ireland. Nothing against it. It just was the missionary. The so-called missionary was the thing that attracted me. It was like the adventure, going out into a whole new world. And so I joined this seminary after school. I was about 18 or so, and it was an 8-year program. I went to university. I went to a second university, theological one. And it was at a time when the Catholic Church was opening up. It was at a transition time, the 60s. We had our own 60s in the Catholic Church, the Vatican Council, they called it. And it was promising a different kind of church that was much more reflective of the experience that I've just described earlier. And so becoming a missionary had less to do with proselytizing. It was emerging, and more to do with, I don't know, mutual enhancement, mutual enrichment, learning from each other. That was how I was understanding it. Liberation theology was unfolding, a sense of how can you help people be more human and be more themselves, freer from systems that oppress and so on. And so it was that drew me and probably kept me, even though I early on found myself running up against the trappings of authority, of a hierarchical system. But I sort of kind of held on to it. Perhaps I'm loath almost to say it this way, but almost like became ordained with my fingers crossed, hoping that this is where this church was going to go. And I was a priest ordained for 20 years. That's a big piece of my life, 28 years in total. And I spent the first 5 years in Africa. And I can talk more about any aspect of that. Those first 5 years, I'll say this much, were like a Camelot period. They were so alive with all the possibilities that I've just described. Being involved in people's lives, not in any kind of neo-colonial way, but in a way of simply becoming friends. My missionary method was like, wow, is that the way you do it? And I loved it. And for my troubles, again, I got kicked upstairs. I spent a few years in the academic field in Rome. And for those few years, it was like also a discovery of the changes that were going on all over the world in this Christian, it so happened, of course, my context world. And then there was a sea change. In 1978, the Catholic Church elected John Paul II. The United States elected Ronald Reagan. The UK elected Margaret Thatcher. They were all cut from the same cloth, and it was clearly a time of closing the lid on a Pandora's box. And when I went back to Africa after Rome, there had been a sea change. And that, if you like, began the process of my own exit, which took some years, but that was it.
So it seems like there was this shift externally that took the alignment out for you. And from my understanding, what that led you towards was ecology. And to me, that's a little bit interesting to understand, because the ethereal almost transcends the dirt at our feet. So I'm wondering how that connection happened.
Well, I think two things. One was I was looking for a new framework. The old framework no longer held. It seemed to have been born out of a perhaps well-intentioned, but nonetheless neo-colonial mindset. And it was no longer either functional or appropriate, it seemed to me. So I was looking for a larger framework. And so ecology, it was more than ecology. It was Thomas Berry who kind of speaks more of a cosmology, a larger cosmology, and talks about the story of the universe, the story of life and where human beings fit in, and that our old story was no longer functional and we needed a new one. And so he was talking about an emerging universe and the connectedness of that, and ecology in that sense. So that gave me a new framework. The second response would be that, as I said at the beginning, my first so-called spiritual experience was lying in the dirt. dirt about up in the heather in the mountains. And it was very clear to me that it was alive. It was alive. And everything that I could see was Gerard Manley Hopkins, a Jesuit poet, one time says, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. And you know what? I've always kind of sensed that, if you like, deep intrinsic beauty in things, if we're able to see it. It's hard sometimes for all kinds of reasons to see it. So it wasn't such a big shift. One, a framework, and two, was like kind of going deeper, in a sense, into the dirt.
I would love to dive deeper into that framework. You mentioned Thomas Berry and providing a new story. Could you share a bit more about who Thomas Berry was for those that don't know, and a bit more on what this new story is and was?
Well, Thomas Berry was a Catholic priest. He died about 3 or 4 years ago, and from North Carolina. He was a cultural historian. He was something of an expert on many of the other religions and faiths, and wrote about Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. And then he himself was impacted, I think, by the environmental challenges, particularly in the 70s and into the 80s. And when I met him first, I was looking for, I feel like, a focus for a dissertation, a new framework, as I said, and met him. He had just written his first book of that nature called The Dream of the Earth, and a set of essays about sort of seeing the interconnectedness of things, the spirituality of ecology, if you like. He would talk like this, that every culture has its story of origins. That's what a cosmology is, where life comes from and where human beings fit in. And it's that story that allows us, enables us to get up in the morning, to make sense of things whenever they go awry, whenever we become ill or lose someone, because we can, it's held together by that story. He said that the story of the Western world in particular had become increasingly dysfunctional, partly because of the advent of science, the growth of science that pushed this God up in the sky kind of thing further and further back until he no longer was relevant in people's lives. The problem was nothing had come to replace it. So people were without a story. And he felt that the great work of our time was to recreate, to surface from our, probably from our dialogues, from our cross-cultural interfaith dialogues, a new story of what it means to be a human being today. I think that's probably the essence of it. He did write a book with a physicist called Brian Swim called The Universe Story, where he sort of laid out the scientific story, but says, no, that's only the skeleton. It really, it's up to human beings, all of us, the poets, the artists in particular, but all of us, to tell our stories as a way of putting flesh on that new cosmology. And in some senses, that probably sparked my fascination with dialogue as a way of doing that.
I feel like that would be a connector into both dialogue and to some of your later work in the ecological realm. Maybe we can stick to the latter for now. I'm thinking about your connection to the Earth Charter, and for those that haven't heard of it on the call, it was an amazing piece of work that really pushed forward the collective consciousness, I would say. Could you share a bit more about your role in that process of writing it?
There were a number of early Earth Charters that were folded into what is the present Earth Charter program. And I suppose some of us who were involved with the UN back in the beginning of the 90s were some of the originators of the first documents. I had been working with the UN Environment Program creating what was called an Environmental Sabbath. And what it meant was trying to engage the religions of the world in the environmental issues. So we created kits, both of scientific material, but also resources from the different perspectives of Buddhism and Islam and Christianity and so forth, and sent them out, thousands and thousands of kits around the world, to encourage religious leaders to show their people the role of religion and in caring for the earth, and that's the broadest way of putting it. After that was kind of the spark. In 1989, the UN General Assembly announced the Earth Summit for Brazil in 1992, and the first item on the agenda was to be an Earth Charter. So I created a group called International Communities for the Renewal of the Earth, and I got a little funding for that and would get myself invited to speak at conferences on each continent and in return to be able to draw from the other speakers from the different religions, they would be often interfaith, a workshop where I could work on an Earth Charter. And so the Earth Charter unfolded out of a process of these little interfaith conversations on every continent. And I was down in Kerala in India, I was in Nairobi in Kenya, I was in Brazil, I was in all over the place. And it was a beautiful little document that emerged. And I had one criterion, and that was that it should sing, that it should not be like other documents that are going to be loaded on. We will do that, and they will be necessary in their own way, but at least the preamble should sing. And I'll give you just the first couple of lines out of the preamble, and you can see what I was saying. It begins, I am because we are. I am because we are. And ironically, the UN organization of the state of Georgia in the United States commissioned a musician to actually turn that preamble into a piece of music, and used the words, it became something that was actually recorded, and so that kind of highlighted that. I could probably say more, but that Earth Charter we brought to the Earth Summit in Brazil. Maybe I'll say this much: the world of nations was not ready for the radical nature of an Earth Charter, and the Earth Charter was demoted on the agenda to a Rio Declaration, which never went anywhere. Mm. So meanwhile, what we did was use whatever connections we had in the interfaith world to bring together religious leaders of the world, including the Dalai Lama, Dom Helder Camara, the Kayapo Indians, the street children of Rio, and had this wonderful celebration in the old assembly building in downtown Rio, where we proclaimed this Earth Charter. As I said, later on, it was folded into a larger process at The Hague in Holland with Mikhail Gorbachev and Stephen Rockefeller and a handful of other people.
Mm. And the thread that seems to come out is the depth with which the Earth Charter was written, and of course depth to a certain degree, and certainly have gone deeper since. And it seems like one of the big impediments to getting it ratified and more deeply acknowledged by the Earth community was the readiness of people, which seems to dovetail into your interest in dialogue. Was that part of the rationale to dive deeper into how to convince people?
Well, yes, interesting you put the question that way. After Rio, continued with the Earth Charter as a tool, and I would offer retreats or speak at a conference or something like that. But what happened, it began to feel to me like this was like like religion in this sense, that it was too big. It was too enormous, too general. I remember an old story about the guy who came out of parachuted out of a plane and was blown off path by the wind, and he landed in some remote area in a tree, and he was yelling for help for hours and hours and hours, and finally someone came by, and he caught his attention, and he shouted down, "Hey, hey, hey!" The person looked up, he says, "Hey, where am I?" And the person on the ground looked up and said, "You're in a tree." and he said, "You must either be a religious leader or a politician." And the guy on the ground says, "Yeah, why? Why?" He says, "Because what you say is absolutely true and absolutely irrelevant." And there's a lot of religion that's like that, absolutely true, but it doesn't really connect with people's everyday lives. And that was maybe my motivation for stepping away even from this and looking at, are there tools? Could there be something that would help us to access these deeper dimensions that would be accessible, more easily accessible to more people? And I think, the way I would put it is this: most people will not meditate in their lives. It's a small percentage. But everybody talks, or at least in some form, even if it's sign language. And if we were able to raise the level of our conversation by 5%, we could change the world. We would certainly change our world, because we would see things differently. And it was that kind of thinking that pushed me into the world of dialogue. And I can say more about its application, but that was, I think, the core. If that makes sense, I don't know.
Absolutely. There's something about being able to pierce one's assumptions in life in a way that is easy to digest, if you will. And maybe it would be helpful if you could dive more into the details and the nitty-gritty of what dialogue means as a process to you.
Well, it came up a number of times during the first sharing of this morning. Dialogue, different depths, different levels. The word dialogue, this helps me. It comes from two Greek words, dia and logos. Dia means through, and logos is meaning. So the way I've defined it is, how do we interact in a way that allows meaning to come through? Wow, that is actually very powerful, because what it says is no one has any monopoly on meaning beforehand, and that meaning is a process, it's an unfolding process that you and I actually create together. Now, for the Greeks, logos had a sense of ultimate meaning. In the Christian Gospels, the Gospel of St. John begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God." The word that they use in Greek for that is logos. "In the beginning was the logos, and the logos was God." So basically, for the Greeks, dialogue was a sacred act. It was a way of participating in the co-creation of life, of meaning, the birthing of God, in a sense. So for me, it has amazing potential, profundity, and at the same time, accessibility. It is not the same as the other forms of conversation, which are appropriate in their way. Debate comes from the words de battery, which means to beat down. So most of our debates are nothing more than trying to beat down the opposition. Well, if you do, you only have one winner, and you don't have new meaning. You just have one, the one that was there before. Happens to be a stronger voice or whatever. The word discussion comes from the Latin discutere, to cut in two. And it's appropriate for things that you already kind of have data for, evidence for, analyzing, coming up with the better solution if the information is limited. But when you're dealing with something that you don't know, and that is the case often, discussion will not be enough. And debate will certainly not be enough. Unfortunately, our halls of leadership are characterized by debate, and it's not helpful. It's not creative. Dialogue is a different thing. It requires all of the things that people were saying in the early sharing. It requires a different kind of intention. What's your intention? Well, my intention is to surface new meaning, to access creativity. Okay, well, that's intention. You need more than good intention. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, we say. So what about attitudes? Well, people spoke about, for example, openness. I have found that there are three basic attitudes which seem to comprise the essential attitudes that we need: openness, empathy, and equality. And if you think about any other kind of characteristic that you think attitude we would need, they probably fit into those three. That's a good little game to play. Openness. Openness means curiosity, willingness to be changed. Empathy means I kind of get this, a sense of who you are. I connect through story with you. Equality, even though there may be a functional hierarchy in a system, an organization, in dialogue there's an essential equality, that what you say is every bit as important as what I say, and vice versa. So those attitudes, if you like, allow the intention to be realized. But then there's one further thing. Even if I have good intention and I've cultivated good attitudes, I might be still awful at listening. There are skills, and there are skills, and there are lifelong practice of learning how to listen. Listen to another person. Listen to myself, which is probably a bigger conversation that's going on internally. Listen for what's trying to emerge, and so on. And so I find that in dialogue, they're summarized into this. I connect with one other, 10 others, 5 others, and discover together. Insofar as I connect deeply, show up, care, all of the words that people were using this morning, something happens. Differences are brought together, not to be merged or defeated, but held. And in that creative tension, something emerges, like electricity being generated. You know, here's a thought. I love poetry because I feel that the poets speak out of that deeper place, and the place that dialogue refers to. And here's one piece. It's by Rilke, and it seems to capture the essence of this dialogue process that you're asking about. And he says this: "My life is not this steeply sloping hour in which you see me hurrying. Much stands behind me. I stand before it like a tree. I am only one of many mouths, and that the one that would be still the soonest. There is the framework for dialogue that he's offering. There's a universe behind every face. And then in the second stanza, here's what he says. I am the rest between two notes, which are somehow always in discord, because death's note wants to climb over. But in the dark interval, reconciled, they stay there trembling, and the song goes on, beautiful. And you can hear what he's saying. You know, I am the rest between two notes which are somehow always in discord. The difference is because we all see the world from different places.
Mm.
The tendency is for one to defeat the other. But in the dark interval, reconciled, not agreed to, just reconciled, they stay there trembling. So you get that sense of tension and the creativity that's engendered. But in the dark interval, reconciled, they stay there trembling, and the song goes on. Beautiful.
Mm.
I think for me that kind of captures a lot of what dialogue is about.
Danny, in listening to you, I feel a sense of expansiveness inside, certainly deep resonance, and the questions pop up as follow-on. What's arising in me, it sounds like there's two aspects that are needed to engage in dialogue. The first is mutual agreement that we'll all operate in this way. But the second is that it seems like you need to be a specific kind of person to even be able to engage in such a way. I'm sure we know people in all of our lives who struggle with openness and empathy, and these seem to be prerequisites. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile that? How do people develop those skills to even engage in such a way?
Well, I think, first of all, it can happen spontaneously in spite of yourself. You know, I was talking to kids about dialogue the other day as a way of accessing the true self. This was a college class. And I said to them, what happened after the explosion, the Boston bombing? What happened immediately? And they said, chaos, fear. And I said, what else? And somebody said, people rushed into the flames or into the explosion to help others. I says, wow, what was that about? And I said, would you do that? And they thought about it, and I put it another way. I said, if a child ran out in front of a car and you were there, you would throw yourself in front of it. You couldn't help yourself. It's almost like there is a deep sense, a deep self in all of us that is so connected that sometimes life will break in and create the conditions for this to happen. There's all of us have tasted that, moments when you rise above yourself. So that's one thought. It is possible because life makes it that way, and in some senses, life is living us. But I think we can create and practice because it is a discipline. Like all arts, and I call it the art of dialogue, it requires real skills, but they need to be practiced and integrated. You can begin with mutual agreement. Yeah, well, mutual agreement, what? Not necessarily mutual agreement around the topic, but mutual agreement to try to listen to each other. That's all you need. If I have a brother-in-law who's a very different sort of in terms of his politics than I am. I'll not tell you my politics. You could probably guess. So, you know, he became like, almost like, don't mention the war, we used to say. You know, don't mention politics when we're together for family gatherings, because it turns into, like, you know, a chaos and argument and so forth. So a few years ago, I decided, you know, I don't agree with him at all, but I'm going to really try to listen. And I did. And he and I have become really good friends. We still don't agree at all on politics, but when we come together, there's a capacity to at least hold the differences, and little glimpses come out. And one final little thought is, you know, that even if you're the only one in a group that's genuinely trying to listen differently, the dynamic actually shifts. Think of it this way. Often when someone you know, is aggressive with me, I tend to be aggressive in return, and I contribute to the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of simply responding in like manner, I do something else. I listen, and I keep listening. The dynamic has changed. The outcome will be different. It may not be radically different or immediately different. The person, though, will probably feel, something has happened here. What are you doing? I can remember my brother-in-law sitting one time and turning to me, and he said, "You're really listening to me, aren't you?" And it was like, yeah. So I don't really think that it takes, you know, a special kind of person. I think, one, that happens to all of us. We all know what it feels and tastes like. And two, it's just a mutual agreement to listen to each other. And insofar as we can be present in that way, connect in that way, something will happen.
Something. Well, Danny, I feel like we could keep going, and I am mindful of the time. I think we have one more question that can be asked before shifting over to the audience. I should mention *6 is what we need to press to get in the queue. I wanted to ask you about the direction that society is heading as it relates to communication. I'm finding that technology is taking over more and more. We've got online, email, chats, all these forms of asynchronous communication. Do you feel that dialogue is possible in these methods, and what can we be doing to try to bring that ethos into this new world?
Well, in the first place, this technology is here, and it's certainly here increasingly with the younger generation. It has to be worked with, accepted, and so on. My early conclusions were that nothing can replace face-to-face, and I still probably hold that to a certain extent. I've been a little bit more convinced in recent times. I've done some work with a group called RISE. Comes out of England, but it's worldwide. And what they create are virtual global collaborations. That's what they describe them as. And I've become a little engaged with them. And what they have sort of revealed to me is that there are many situations that technology allows a conversation to take place that wouldn't take place otherwise. Say, for example, interns and CEOs in the business community. They can actually make these things happen because it's much more easily orchestrated, set up online than the difficulties of one-on-one. Or if it's worldwide, since we have the technology, you can have someone in Australia, South Africa, Asia, Ireland, and America on a conversation too. So the potential for bringing people together is, I think, enormous. My second point, though, is the same principles of dialogue and the art of conversation apply, but even more deliberately so. Because since we don't have the body language and the signals of the face-to-face, we have to be even more focused on listening in a particular way, taking certain kinds of steps. For example, a typical RISE conversation will begin the way yours did, maybe with a moment of silence. But then with a trust-building question, and there's an art to finding what that might be for a particular group that allows trust to grow. And I have seen it happening over a period when it's consistently done over a period of months, trust really building, almost as powerful as face-to-face, and out of it coming really creative processes. So it's not a complete answer at all to your question, but I think there's potential, but it will take a deliberateness of a new order.
Mm. Birju, if you don't mind me jumping in with a question. Danny, this is Rahul. I wanted to actually take a step back toward what you were doing with climate before. You know, the way I think about global climate change is that it's perhaps one of the greatest threats humanity has ever faced. But it's also clear to me that we can't really expect any change in our outer world until we make changes in our inner world. And historically, religion has been one of those tools that sort of holds the promise to make a transformation in that inner world. And so there seems to be sort of a very vital connection there. You know, most religions talk about, openness and empathy as ways of sort of bettering ourselves or the state that we're sort of trying to get to. I know that you were talking about how the, you know, religious communities and maybe the world at large just wasn't ready for the Earth Charter when you were pushing it. But I'm wondering if you see any changes that are occurring on the macro level, especially in the last decade or so where, you know, people like Al Gore have sort of gotten out there very publicly, gotten climate change into people's, mindsets, and whether you see a connection between sort of empathy and equality, generosity and openness in affecting something on what could, affecting some change on what could be our greatest challenge.
Well, I'll give you two concrete examples as a way of responding. First one was about 4 or 5 years ago, here where I live in northern Westchester, New York, the town of Bedford. Global warming was the term that was used at the time. And so people were talking about it and worried about it. So a few of us decided to convene what we called just a community conversation that took on the name later on of Conversations for Action. And we just simply brought people together. I can remember the first gathering in the public library and a record turnout of people. And the thing that they remembered was not the speakers. We had one of Al Gore's people there, interestingly, to present the information. We had local leadership, the new congressperson, and so forth. But the thing that people remembered was I invited people to break up into smaller groups and talk about what was on their mind. What does this stir in you? What is the anxiety? What is the story? What are you thinking about? And so on. And I looked down at one stage, and there was my mother-in-law, who was 91 years old at the time, in one group, and also in the group, a 12-year-old girl. And these conversations were fascinating. So out of it, we developed a simple little model, nothing new, really, but of gathering the community. We had a series of such conversations for action. To fast forward, the town board took notice, and they invited us to create an energy advisory panel. I sat on it. We created a climate action plan, extremely kind of, complicated in some ways, but looking at various aspects of energy use. The town board accepted the climate action plan, integrated it into its legislation process as a criterion. The plan won every award in the state. An energy advisory panel was formed out of it, an implementation group is now a nonprofit standing on its own. It has held two summits for the community. We're 16,000 people in the community. We had over 1,000 people at each of those summits. And they have task forces, action forces, that are working in all of the various areas. Now, it's a good success story, and it's local, and it's real. And it is something of a shift in consciousness. It's not that profound, because the way the emphasis went in this first iteration was, it makes sense to do an energy audit in your house. It makes sense financially. You'll save money over time, and you're also reducing the carbon footprint. So at a local level, it was good. People were asking the larger question, of course, in time, what does this mean in a world like that includes all the 7-8 billion people in the world? What difference will our little effort make? And the hope was that lots of efforts like this would make a difference. That's one story. The second one was just recently, in fact, last week, at a UN group where a couple of researchers were presenting their material on the new level of urgency of climate change. And they wanted to use the religions as a way of kind of spreading this word. And I said, you know, that's all very well, and it's true, and but it's slower. All the things that religions do, yes, do foster a sense of empathy and connectedness and so forth and sensitivity. And it's ongoing, and one must do that. And they have structures for reaching out into the... But that's old. That's an old method. It hasn't really worked in the way that we're talking about, especially in the face of urgency. Seems to me that what's required is something else. The shift in consciousness that you're talking about is a shift to a collective consciousness that I just described earlier as happened spontaneously in Boston in the face of this crisis, and happens all the time in the face of crisis. I'm saying, how do you cultivate that? Is it possible? And I'm thinking this is a question and a method that where dialogue can fit that transcends religions. Not the deeper spiritual dimensions of religion, but religions. It's saying that people can come together and can be helped to talk about this sense of urgency that they feel. They, and in a dialogue setting, they will be able to surface creative responses. And I think that's the direction that perhaps is worth exploring more.
Thank you.
Hi, Danny. I just wanted to say thank you very much for just the incredible shares that you've made today. The question I had for you is, you know, on a very sort of practical day-to-day level, you know, you talked about ways in which you can shift the conversation, even just by the way that you listen. I mean, you know, and having been in situations where you've probably come across a variety of conflict in some of those dialogues or those conversations, what are some other tools that you've used to bring the collective to a sort of consensus, even just on a base, like, you know, base language or a common understanding? Because I often feel like when you're in a situation where there's a great deal of conflict, like when you're, let's say, at the UN and there's differing opinions, or whether it's, you know, folks from different religions talking about the same topic with differing viewpoints, how do you, you know, create that common understanding to have an effective dialogue?
That's a great question, and it's been pondered by so many, including myself. One of the challenges I have often found in interfaith conversations is that they tend to be diatribes, and people sort of stand up and say, this is what our religion says, and this is what our guru says, and this is what Jesus says. And I feel like saying, you know, I don't really care, because that's all. And what's important is I want to know what you care, what you think, what you feel, what your story is. And I know this much, that when people tell their story, and this came up in the early sharing too, something shifts. If I hear your story, I cannot see you as, I see you differently, maybe put it more positively. If I can be vulnerable enough to tell you my story, honestly, show up, I know it will elicit such a story from you. When we share our story, there's nothing more powerful for connecting us. People see connections that they never saw before. I have worked with groups, executive leaders who have worked together for 10 years and didn't know each other. And when they, a simple little exercise in 15 or 20 minutes, and say, I didn't know that about you. And the level of empathy that rises with that is amazing. So insofar as people can be helped to share their story, not what their positions are, not what their theological or otherwise positions are, it's like, stop. Tell me what you feel. Tell me what's going on for you. When that happens, I believe you create. It's almost like cultivating the soil for something new to happen. And at the risk of sort of being naive or simplistic, I think there are simple techniques for gathering emerging agreement. And you know, very obvious things is, say, after a session like that, little stories are being told, just to get people then to say, well, what do you think we hear ourselves saying? It's a simple little question. And then use a technique for, you know, compiling and merging and voting, even if necessary, to see where the energy of the group is. Helping people to find shared agreement, I think, is confidence building as well as creative in terms of accessing insight. I don't know if that helps, but there's a couple of things that I have found helpful in shifting the conversation.
No, I think that's great. And Rahul, if I may, I just have one other question I wanted to sneak in there. Very much along the same lines that, you know, and so that seems to be some pretty effective tools, I would think, to bring it to the individual level. And then, you know, I noticed that you do some, like, I guess some, let's call it guidance or life coaching to a certain degree. I mean, how about creating that shift or that dialogue within the individual themselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to allow them to step outside themselves for a moment to see, you know, sort of an, I don't want to say an objective, because that's very difficult to do to a certain degree, but, you know, how to step outside themselves to see their viewpoint a little bit differently.
You know, exactly. You put it very well. How do you get out of yourself? How do you get out of your own way? Because it's because we're, a term that has helped me is my own prison of perception. Someone talked about, you know, mental constructs. Another poet says, we don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are. You know, and we're a product of culture, family, circumstances, and even moods. So what we pursue. So how do you get out of your own way? And one of the, you know, there's all kinds of things that could be, you know, when and on an individual level, I do a little thing like the River of Life. And on one page, bottom left-hand corner is when you were born. Top right-hand corner is today. Draw a river of your life. They're so intrigued. It's very simple. And again, in 5 minutes, you get a sense. Oh, I said, well, who do you see in there? And it's helping people access that part of themselves that so often gets forgotten or lost. And there is a simple little technique. It's related to the storytelling piece. A second aspect of it, and I'm sure this is very obvious to everybody, is, you know, getting out of your own way by, say, going and working in a place that's a little bit unfamiliar and using that as an opportunity to be disturbed, to be sort of knocked off your little assumptions about the way things are. And that is, it's often been the case when people get out of their comfort zone and even just go to another culture if they have the wherewithal to do that, or go around the corner to work in some other little place in service. It just opens up your heart. So that's kind of where I'm inclined to go on the one-on-one. It's like accessing the part of yourself that's there all the time, but it gets suppressed because of our, you know, concerns about survival or what we've been told or the pressure of society and so on.
Thank you, Danny. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Hi, Danny. I'm wondering if perhaps as we talk about how to engage in conversations and what communities are or are not doing, is there perhaps a meta conversation going on with the key speaker being media? And to what extent does media either facilitate or prevent meaningful dialogue from taking place?
Oh, that's an intriguing question. You know, let's look at it from, you know, in the immediate of, say, the Boston experience. Clearly, there were different levels of that meta conversation going on. Just to sort of mention some of them, like the basic fear of attack, the prejudices against particular communities, what's happening in our society that produces this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there were meta conversations in a way at multiple levels that were taking place, and some groups were addressing those and some others. And there were also, in terms of the media, some doing a good job and some doing an awful job. I heard on a program this morning somebody reporting on the New York Post, one of the second biggest newspaper in the United States, and ridiculous reporting on, you know, a Saudi suspect or whatever, that all it did was confuse the issue and so on. Or you know, someone else, I think it was Chris Matthews on MSNBC, making some silly statement about, you know, what could this have been about, and throwing out broad, sweeping kinds of statements that only stirred up people's anxiety. It feels to me that there's a role for the media, and it would be almost a dialogical role as well, to convene perspectives, to explore assumptions, and to surface possibility. And you get it occasionally, and some media groups are better than others. It reminds me that, you know, I lived in Africa for years, and I refused, well, I couldn't access a daily newspaper anyway, but I learned only to look at weekly newspapers, and I began to feel that a weekly newspaper was more likely to have a reasoned reflection on a topic because there was more time and a little bit more research, and that often daily news was little more than gossip and reactive gossip at that. So I think an awful lot of our media has become little more than that. It stirs up ratings by exciting or frightening people. And so there's a real responsibility for the media, and some play it well. I don't know if that's really what you were getting at.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. You know, sometimes I see something and wonder, but it's always helpful to get validation from somebody else.
It's interesting, but on another thread, we were just circulating an article about how some studies came out recently showing that news, listening to mainstream news, is actually bad for your health. And I think it dovetails very well with what you were saying about you know, this 24-hour news cycle just being gossip and reactive instead of the measured, reasoned, reflective space for dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would love to see more media groups. It's not very profitable because, you know, it doesn't capture the ratings, and so the advertisers won't support it, but it's such an interesting kind of prison to break out of.
Sure. We'll move on to the next question.
Oh, hi. I was interested to hear you talk about things like the Boston bombing as a catalyst for shifting consciousness and bringing out things like empathy and collaboration. The speaker, I heard a talk at Stanford last night where the speaker was saying very much the same thing. It was about genius and his view. It seemed like it almost takes a crisis or a tragedy or challenge of some sort to spark creativity and genius. And he thought that prosperity and ease pretty much just makes people complacent. And on the one hand, it's encouraging that, well, gee, if we feel like we're failing or in crisis, that there's a sunny side to it. But it's just sad to think that it would always take something like that to spark creativity. Do you think that's the case?
Well, think of the moments when you were at your best. That's an interesting kind of reflection. They're not all doom and gloom. You know, there are moments when you soar. You know, you're in good company, good conversation, part of a good team. You know, listening to good music, that can also, I think, touch into that truer self, both individual and collective, and I'm not too sure if there's any difference between the two. Well, that's a larger conversation. At the same time, I think it's also true, those moments that when life breaks in, I used to use the term a cosmic nudge. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, when I almost drowned one time, and anyone who's had such an experience probably remembers things like, my God, if I get out of this, and from now on, or now I know what's important. Or I can remember when my father died. I was very close to him, and the way the circumstances just blew my mind. And I find myself, like so many people, now I see what's important. Interestingly, there's a tradition in the Irish Christian world and also in the Jewish world, I believe, that when someone dies, you cover the mirrors. And the purpose, the reason is that it's like a time for suspending your identity in a sense. You don't see your reflection. To allow death in, because death will break down the old kind of identities and illusions that we sort of surround ourselves with. And then when the cloth is taken off the mirror, there is that real sense that you've been changed because life has broken in. So I kind of think that what that suggests is that there's life does it for you, and you can cooperate with life in accessing this truer self. And we're going to need that kind of self to address the complex issues of things like climate change.
This is Michelle Ehlers calling in from Santa Fe. Thank you so much, Dandy, for everything you're sharing. It's a great gift. As somebody who's grown up in many parts of the world, I did my childhood in Africa, I've lived in China and Europe, and now have a very strong commitment to environment and bringing awareness to what we need to do. And having worked in transformational global leadership for a long time, one of the very strong questions that's in my mind and I wake up with every morning is, how do we... this is what occurs to me, so feel free. I'm open for coaching here. Because how do we bring a commitment to do something that will make a difference, particularly on the part of people who are living lifestyles that are totally unsustainable? I've grown up in many different kinds of lifestyles, and I've taken on a personal commitment to try and live a sustainable lifestyle, which is difficult in the United States. But how do we bring more awareness that there actually is a particular kind of lifestyle that is sustainable for every human being? We may not know exactly what it is, but there are a lot of people working on that. That goes way beyond changing a few light bulbs and buying a car that's a little bit less demanding on gasoline. Do you have any ideas about that? In a time frame that will actually make a difference.
Well, in a time frame that will actually make a difference is a good writer. for that. One thought last night it came up. I was at an event and people were talking about the challenge of change, the threat of change, because at some level it feels like personal annihilation to change in the way that's needed. So when we think of things like climate change, it's like death. And so that would be one thought. The second thought would be that it, somehow or another, it has to be presented as attractive. We're not going to draw people by saying, well, here's this awful scenario that we're going to have to live. It may be the case at some stage of a process, but what you're trying to say is we could actually live a better life and a fuller life and a richer life that is also sustainable. But how do you create that? One thought, again, it's time frame is a big, big issue, so leave aside that for the moment. I talked earlier about how do you foster the collective shift, the collective consciousness that was present in Boston. I think that's a conversation that could be, strategized around. But, cultivating a sense of, a different kind of a world. I'll give you an example. What I was celebrating last night was the founder of a race here, where I live. And our house abuts 5,000 acres of county property, and every year we have a race. It's about 7 miles long. It's through the river three times. It's up a sand pit. It is very hard, and it's going to be cold tomorrow, and 1,500 people will run it. And these people are not in the slightest bit interested in religion, most of them. That's a broad generalization, but that's not why they're there. But they see this as a spiritual event of connectedness. And I have the privilege of beginning the race for the last 8 years, and I have created a Celtic Navajo chant. beauty before me as I run, beauty behind me as I run, beauty below me as I, and so on. You could hear a pin drop. 1,500 people full, ready to go on this challenging race. And It's they come back year after year and the numbers grow because people want to taste something that feels right. These, for me, they're non-religious. in any formal sense or in the traditional sense, but looking for ways into people's lives that can help them connect to things that are simple, that are connected to earth, the beauty of a place like this, the beauty of getting yourself all mudded up, are ways in which we would need to look. So on the one hand, there's the emergency, and that's a strategy in itself. And the other is the ongoing attempt to create a sense of commitment that's born out of a taste of something else.
Danny, one last question before we close the call. I was wondering how we as an audience can be supportive of your work and journey.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. I write a blog every couple of weeks. I just wrote one on the Boston Marathon. DannyMartin.org might be sort of, I would love to continue the conversation that way. That's one thought. Two, I'd love to know what kinds of things are going on in your world, wherever you are, like the Bedford effort that I talked about. It would seem to me that if we can maybe share with each other, that's another level of the dialogue. And three, and I suppose it's related to that, this kind of conversation this morning as a way of sharing experiences of trying to, you know, access creativity, access a truer self, a truer collective self too, would be powerfully enriching for me. Those three things.
Well, thank you. We will definitely send out a link to the blog and to that resource to be able to connect and continue that dialogue.